As a raker of muck, it's my job to root out the nefarious doings and innate immorality of the corporate creature. But I'm in danger these days of being rendered obsolete by what's become the ordinariness of corporate nefariousness. The wrongdoings of major corporations and entire industries are now so commonplace that one hardly has to root them out. Their uglies are constantly oozing to the surface on their own from today's fetid corporate swamp. What's happened is that a profiteering imperative has taken hold of the executive suites. Not content with merely making a profit, CEOs are out to make a killing, no matter what it costs the rest of us. This has turned them into rank thieves, richly rewarded for routinely exploiting America's workforce, plundering the environment, and corrupting our governments. Top executives have also seen that they'll pay no personal price for rapacious behavior, since the corrupted political and judicial systems show no serious interest in prosecuting, much less punishing, perpetrators who get caught. In recent months, two huge examples of this rampant crime spree have erupted. One, after Big Pharma bought out several reasonably priced medicines from independent drug makers, the avaricious giants immediately gouged unsuspecting patients by quadrupling their prices. And two, Volkswagen joined the Automobile Hall of Shame by secretly rigging computers on its highly advertised green vehicles to hide the fact that they actually spew horrendous amounts of pollution into Earth's atmosphere. This is Jim Hightower saying, an ethos of anything goes now rules the top floor suites of most major corporations. The use of blatant lies, PR cover-ups, and zero top-level accountability is now central to the corporate business model. They don't care if they get caught. Profit has taken ethics prisoner, and corporate elites now call the devil partner.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Say Hey, it is Monday, time is 5:30, you're listening to Say Hey right here on 90.1 KZFR, Chico's only locally produced sports talk radio program. In honor of Martin Luther King Day, we're going to run a special presentation on Negro League Baseball, so stick around for the next half hour, and I'm sure you're going to learn a few things.
My name is William Blair Jr. Father's name was William Blair Sr. My mother's name was Cora Ross Blair. Started playing baseball when I was 10 years old at the YMCA on Floor and Bowl. Well, at the YMCA, they had a league down there. And I was playing with boys older than me when I was 12 years old. Woody Cutton, Barney Sorrell. Barney Sorrell is the one they went to get when they signed Jackie. Hello, ball. Played second base. Well, he played on the same team with Jackie, the Kansas City Monarchs.
What did he say about Jackie?
Well, I saw him one time. I saw him in 1946 before he went to Mexico. Oh, there was no doubt about Jackie being a great ball player, but it was a whole lot of Negro better ball player than Jackie Robinson. Whole lot of.
No one to walk with, I'm all by myself. No one to talk with, but I'm happy on a shelf.
I would like to thank all of you for being here this evening. Baseball is a game for the young and old, and it is good to see a mix of young and old here tonight. For the younger generation, you need to know that your elders here this evening are all young at heart. I would like to thank some special guests for being here, and we're going to start with Dr. William Blair, who pitched in the Negro Leagues in the late 1940s. In the late 1950s, he was the founder and publisher of the Elite News in Dallas. In the 1980s, he was the force behind the Martin Luther King Jr. Parade in Dallas. He is known as the legend. Dr. Blair, thank you very much for coming and being here to support me tonight. In 2010, when I believed God had a plan for me to write and speak about the Black Ball era, which is segregated or Negro League baseball, I needed the blessing from two groups of people. One, baseball historians, and two, former players from the Black Ball era. In July 2010, I attended my first Lester Malloy Negro League baseball conference in Indianapolis, Indiana, which is where Dr. Blair used to play ball. There were about 100 baseball historians in attendance. There were about a dozen academic presentations on the history of the Negro Leagues, with the focus being on Negro League baseball in the state of Indiana. My primary objective for the conference was to determine if these baseball historians thought my historical fiction book, The Best Season, The First 90 Games, which at that time was still in the process of being written, would have a positive impact in showing how good these players were. And the response was very favorable. I have now had the opportunity to talk to five or six former players from the Negro League. I met Dr. Blair in the fall of 2011. It was definitely a divine appointment. About 3 weeks before I met Dr. Blair, a friend of mine at church asked me if I saw on the local news channel that a former player from the Negro Leagues had a ballpark in South Dallas named after him. I said, no. What is his name? Well, my parishioner friend could not remember. And through a local jazz station, I found out the person I was looking for was Mr. William Blair, the founder and publisher of the Elite News. So I made an appointment to meet him. Now, Dr. Blair does not know me. My two biggest assets I had to share with him were, one, my passion for baseball, which now included the Negro Leagues, and two, a brochure I had my son-in-law produce for the Negro League Baseball Conference. After I introduce myself and review my brochure with him, Dr. Blair looks me straight in the eye, and I mean straight in the eye, and asked me point blank, Bob, who is one of the greatest players in history? And I knew this was my test. If I fail this test, it's strike three and the game is over. I looked Dr. Blair straight in the eye, and with no hesitation, I say, Oscar Charleston. According to Bill James, baseball historian, there were only three players better: Babe Ruth, Honus Wagner, and Willie Mays. Dr. Blair smiles, and I knew I'd hit the ball out of the park.
Meeting Dr. Blair and hearing his story one-on-one just really inspired me. Here's a guy that owns his own newspaper. He's an entrepreneur. He's a businessman. I think I could aspire to just understand and admire a lot of those players back then, but to actually meet one. So if you ask me about a player, Dr. Blair would be someone that I would highly respect.
Well, we were in Birmingham, Alabama. You know, when you went to the Negro League, you had to make good on a contract if you didn't sign that. So, we was playing the Cleveland Buckeyes that had just won the World Championship the year before. So they're going to get rid of me, you know, by my size. So I started the game. I washed them for about 4 or 5 innings. So Tommy Sampson, who was the manager of the Birmingham Black, thinking he can finish it up. I said, oh, yeah, I can finish it up. Here's a man named Winfield Welch, who handled everything for the Harlem Globetrotters in Chicago American Giant for Abe Saperstein. So he gave me $100 bill. I never shall forget. He said, meet me over at the Page Hotel in New Orleans, Louisiana. That's how I got the Negro League.
Okay. Again, the definition of blackball. 1887 to 1946, segregated baseball was the blackball era. In 1947, Jackie Robinson reintegrated baseball. But in 1872, Bud Fowler broke the color line in professional baseball. Fleetwood Walker was playing for Toledo in the American Association in 1887 when the unwritten agreement by the white owners banned black ball players for the next 60 years in Major League Baseball. This period from 1887 to 1947 was 60 years when the great black ball players, the owners of those teams, the managers, the black press, and the fans had to play, watch, and write in the shadows. It was great, exciting baseball, which most of the country missed out on. The era of 1900 and 1919 was mostly independent black baseball teams. Smokey Joe Williams, who was a pitcher, and Pop Lloyd, shortstop, are early stars of the black ball era. In 1920, led by Rube Foster, former great player, the Negro National League was formed with teams primarily from the Midwest, the Chicago American Giants, Indianapolis ABCs, St. Louis Giants, the Detroit Stars, and the Kansas City Monarchs. The Eastern Colored League was formed in 1923 with the Hilldale Daisies, Atlantic City Bacharachs, Baltimore Black Sox, the New York Lincoln Giants, the Brooklyn Royals, and the Harrisburg Giants. In 1924, the first Negro League World Series was played with the Monarchs defeating the Daisies in 10 games. One was tied. 1926, Satchel Paige began his career. Bill James, baseball historian, ranks Paige as the second best pitcher in baseball behind Walter Big Train Johnson of the Washington Senators. Paige was also considered to be the first free agent in baseball. You know, supposedly that happened in the 1970s. Well, Satchel did not mind at all. If somebody offered him $500 to pitch for a weekend, he'd leave his team, the Monarchs or the Grays, whatever, and go pitch somewhere else, and then come back, and he'd always be welcomed back.
And we were playing down in Atlanta. Had a little fellow about Brooks' eye led off with a triple on Satchel. When he got to third base, he's pulling up his britches and everything. Satchel said, young man, see, you know one thing? See, I wasn't going but three tonight. He said, but I'm going to go nine, said, because I'm going to teach you some table now. Boy, it's a shame when you throw that ball. Satchel could do anything Satchel wanted to do. If Satchel said he's going to strike you out, he's going to strike you out. That's what he'd do. Made more money than anybody in the history of baseball. Yeah, airplane when nobody else didn't have that.
That's right.
You know that, did
I didn't.
Hey, sure did. Had a fellow with him named Jew Baby, wasn't this wide all the way up. Hell, if he didn't want you to get to Satchel, you couldn't get to him. But Satchel was a true man. We played in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. You could hear him warming up at it. Boom. 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 That's the back there warming up. That's Satchel. Throw his glove out there and beat them people. Shit. That's how good a pitcher. And didn't walk nobody. Didn't walk nobody. Take a match to him, throw it over there all day long. Throw that all day long.
Thank you.
had that kind of control. They had Satchel Paige, they had Hilton Smith, they had Connie Johnson, they had Big Jack Matthew, throw both hands. A boy named, what's that left hand boy name? Anyway. And Booker McDaniels, six of them. Every day they send somebody out there throwing the ball harder than to throw the day before. Never shall forget one time they was talking about it. You know they was talking about it. You know, the speed on the ball. So Satchel was down there warming up him and Buck O'Neill. He said, what was he throwing? He's throwing over 100. He said, oh man, I didn't know that's what they're doing. He just clicked at 105.
For real?
Who? Booker McDaniel threw harder than him.
Do you think Hilton Smith might have been a better pitcher than Satchel
Paige? Wasn't no different than him and Satchel. Only different him and Satchel, Hilton was light and Satchel was dark. Mm-hmm. Hilton Smith threw a curveball, go around this room and come. Wasn't going to stay up there. Like Brooks told me, stand up there. Couldn't stay up there. You had to get away from that.
There's a picture of Leroy from his Negro League days. That's a picture of Satchel Paige in his Indians uniform as he helped the Indians win their last World Series in 1948. Paige was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1971. Here's a quote from Satchel Paige. Quote, Bell was so fast that he could shut the light off in the hotel room and be in bed before the light was out. That was a quote about James Cool Papa Bell. Well, I got to tell you a funny story. One time they were sharing a hotel, and when Bell went into the room, he noticed that when he shut the light off, there was a delay. So when Satchel came in and he says, hey, Satchel, watch this. Flips the switch. He's actually in bed before the light went out. There's a picture of Cool Papa Bell doing what he did very well, sliding into third base, sliding into home. I mean, and this was a game against a major league team. I forget when it was. It was probably sometime in the 40s. One of the things that the Negro League were expert at, and I've never seen it done in the major leagues. When they had Cool Papa Bell on first base, they'd lay down a bunt, and the objective was not to get Bell to second. The objective was get Bell to third, and that worked all the time. But when they played the major leaguers and did that, Bell ran right past. Well, the catcher saw that nobody was covering third, so he runs to third. Well, Bell runs right by him and scores from first base on a bunt.
Now, I'm going to give you a little story about Cool Papa Bell. We were playing in a little town called Keokuk, Iowa, on a Saturday night. All the money you take on Saturday night, you spit it on the ball players, see. So we had them 2-1, I think about the seventh inning. And Welch came to the top of the dugout. Cool was leading off the seventh inning. He said, Cool, we got to have another run. You got to get on. Cool hit the ball, bam, ball popped in there. First base. If he was playing ball, I didn't never would throw him out. I'm telling you, catchers never would throw him out. If he got on base 100 times, he'd steal 100 bases. That's how fast he was. He was 40 years old the first time I ever saw him in my life. Could I run a deer?
I run a deer.
I run anything you put in front of him. And in this particular instance I was telling you about, he's standing on first base. Well, I said, Cool, so I'm finna put the hit and run on. You got to holler this out. Finna put the hit and run on. So I want you to score on the hit. You remember Dave Pope used to play the Cleveland Indians? Mm-hmm. Hit a line drive, the ball said, bap, bap, right in the left fielder thing. Throw it at the plate, and the man didn't even slide. That's how fast he runs. People in that town now believe he cut through the pitcher's box, he run too fast. He could run with no ball.
Gibson was inducted into the Baseball Hall, if I'm talking Josh. Josh Gibson was inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1972. Bill James ranks Gibson as the greatest catcher in baseball history. Number 9 overall of all players, and Yogi Berra, and I think on there it says he was 21st. Yogi Berra actually is 41st. So of catchers, Gibson was way ahead of everybody. Gibson was a right-handed power hitter, hit over 900 home runs in his career. Some say it might have been 1,000. He's the only player, and this is documented, to hit a ball out of Yankee Stadium. There's Josh. It's a quote from Dizzy Dean. And see, one thing I want you to know, the great players in Major League Baseball recognize the talents of the black ball players. Dizzy Dean, quote on Oscar Charleston, Charleston could hit the ball a mile. He didn't have a weakness at the plate. Now, in this picture, Oscar Charleston is actually behind the umpire in the on-deck circle. By the way, these photos I got from Larry Lester, who is heads up the Negro League Committee for the Society for American Baseball Research, which I'm part of. 1933, Major League Baseball and Negro League Baseball had their inaugural All-Star Baseball Games. The East-West Negro League All-Star Game was played annually at Comiskey Park, and sometimes they had 45,000 to 60,000 people in attendance, mostly black fans. The East-West All-Star Game was what really led to integrated baseball. And in the period from 1933 to 1946, the three dominant Negro League teams were the Kansas City Monarchs, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, and the Homestead Grays. Now, here's a quote from Honus Wagner. Now, Honus Wagner played 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, great shortstop for the Pirates. And he's probably the second best player in baseball history, maybe Babe Ruth, the only one better. And he says, the number two guy in baseball history, Honus Wagner says, I am honored to have John Pop Lloyd called the Black Wagner. It is a privilege to have been compared to him.
I tell you, a ball player, they don't say nothing about it. He didn't go and died in 1978. Probably one of the best ball players that ever lived, mechanically. Junior Gilliam.
Junior Gilliam.
Could play.
Played with the Dodgers.
Played with the Dodgers?
That's right. Played second base. That's where Jackie went play when he first went to the Dodgers. So the second year there in 47 or 40, 47, he told us, well, you got to find you another spot to play because we got a second base. And that was Junior Gilliam. They moved in the first base because Gil Hodges died. And when Gil Hodges played first base, he died. Put Jackie over there. Goose Tatum was the funniest fella that ever lived. Everything he did, it tickled him, wasn't it, better than it did you, because he really enjoyed what he was doing. He was my roommate.
Your roommate?
Yeah, he was my roommate. Well, I wondered if you could get along with him, say anything I wanted to him, do anything I wanted to him. He never get angry at me.
And why did he leave baseball and go to the Harlem Globetrotters?
Well, he made more money.
That's easy.
See, we was in a hotel at the Ferguson Hotel on 22nd and Emma State in Indianapolis, Indiana. A man named Babe Herman came in and threw $10,000 in the bed where Goose was. See, Goose could have made $1 million in Nebraska, Iowa, in all them little towns like that. He made $1 million. He wouldn't take it.
Why not?
I don't know. I know he was just a funny fella. Hell to Red Arkansas. I used to be pissing, he said, hum that rock radio. Hum that rock. Yes, that's how he said to me all the time. Good fellow.
Turkey Stearns, another great player. Stearns was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2002. He won four batting titles in the 1920s. He was a left-handed power hitter. He was also an excellent outfielder with a great arm, great range. Bill James ranked Stearns as number 25 of the top 100 players. There's a picture of Turkey in his Monarchs uniform. He was also played quite a bit for the Detroit Stars. Okay, I want to go over, I'm going to do some things here to focus a bit about how the book was written, why it was written. The purpose was to honor these 21 Negro League stars on the field between the foul lines for a full season of baseball. 165 plus games plus playoffs against 375 of the greatest players in baseball history from the 1880s to the 1980s. And when Satchel Paige was facing these great players, it was going to be best on their base season. Best season. That's why the book was called The Best Season. For example, when Satchel Paige faces Walter Johnson of the Washington Senators, the best pitcher in baseball history, three times in a nine-game series, he's facing the 1913 Walter Johnson, who won 37, lost 6, with a 1.14 earned run average. Now, as far as my background, I'm going to go over that in the last slide. The Lester Molloy Negro League Baseball Conference, Indianapolis, 2011. As I was writing my book, I was encouraged by Dr. Ray Doswell, the executive director of the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, and Dr. Leslie Heafy, the detail editor of Black Ball, a Negro League's journal, to attend this conference, attended by about 100 or so baseball historians, members like myself of the Society for American Baseball Research. I could get some excellent feedback on my writing, as well as learn about the Negro Leagues from about a dozen historical academic presentations. My Honoring Black Ball brochure was designed specifically for this audience. So in July 2011, I attended the four-day conference in Indianapolis. It was wonderful being with all the baseball historians. Even though their focus is historical research, they knew that there was a place for what-if scenarios of historical fiction based on sophisticated game simulation. Let me give you a couple of brief stories from meetings with Monty Irvin and Dr. Blair. Monty Irvin, one of the things I asked him to share with my grandson, Caleb, when we met him a couple years ago, was tell Caleb about the bus rides. So Monty says, you know, we used to play three games in a day, and the three games would be played in three different cities. And they'd ride from one place to the other. In fact, sometimes in those hot days, and the uniforms were very warm uniforms, the old flannel uniforms. He says they used to hang them outside the window, and they'd sit there in their shorts just to keep cool. But he also told Caleb, he says, you know, Caleb, I can sleep better on a bus than in a hotel. And why is that? They slept mostly in a bus, not a hotel. Well, let me just briefly here. Bill James put out a wonderful book for you, for baseball stat guys like myself, on win shares. It basically tells you the value of all the players in baseball history. It's a great book for saying, gee, who really is the greatest player? But using that book of Bill James, Mark Armour wrote an article called Major League Baseball Integration, 1947 to 1986. He was able to use that win share data, and in the first 15 years of integration, let's say from 47 to 62, as he did the comparisons, he noticed that the National League was way better than the American League over that period. And why was that? They did a much better job of bringing up Negro League stars. The great New York Yankees waited 9 years before they brought up Elston Howard. The Boston Red Sox, and I'm from Boston, they were the last team to integrate. They waited 12 years to 1959. What happened in the All-Star games during that 16-year period? 12 wins for the National League, 4 for the American League, because the National League did the job.